Today on Maine Calling, humorist Tim Sample. Tim Sample has been making people laugh for 50 years, here in Maine and on national television. He's more of a storyteller than the kind of comedian who delivers punchlines, but he is also pretty quotable. Sample has said, "Mainers don't tan, they rust," and "Maine is a state of mind, not just a place on the map." Well, Tim Sample recently announced that he is stepping back from live performances to focus on other things, art mainly, and maybe music. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we catch up with the one and only Tim Sample. We'll ask him about this big decision, about American humor today, and maybe get him to tell some stories of his half century of adventures with audiences. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Chances are, when you think of classic Maine humor, you think of Tim Sample, and you smile. For almost 50 years now, Sample has gained a national following in addition to live shows, radio, and a dozen popular albums. As well as his books, Tim spent 11 years as a regular correspondent for CBS News Sunday Morning. Tim, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Gosh, it's really, really a pleasure to be here. Great to see you, because I get to see you. They don't get to see you because I'm on Zoom.
That's right. We're on Zoom and can see each other. We invite all of you in the audience to join the conversation. Do you have a great story to tell about seeing Tim Sample perform? Do you have something you'd like to ask him about humor? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on our Facebook or Instagram pages, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Tim, you recently made a big decision, and I'm not sure the R word is the right word, even though you would deserve that. What are you doing?
Okay, so this is the way I think of it. So I'm in my mid-70s. I have been doing, I've been performing on stage for over 50 years. So 50 years ago would be 1974, and I was in Portland playing in different bands, including the Maxwell Baggins Band and the Dubious Brothers with Steve Byther, went on with the Wicked Good Band. So that's 50 plus years. And I just sort of said to myself, I'm having a wonderful time. Nobody has a better time. I've had so many wonderful experiences, but I just kind of found myself asking myself, where is it written that if you're in the entertainment business, specifically on stage performing, you have to continue to perform live until your grandchildren push you out in a wheelchair and prop up the microphone? And I said, it's not written anywhere. And so what I realize is I have lots of things that I love to do, including write and illustrate. And my illustration I nowadays, last few years, I've done something around a dozen or 15 live shows a year. In the big, in the peak of my career, I was doing 100, 120 a year. So I have time to do things, time to hang around with my grandparents. And when my life expectancy is roughly the same as my Cairn Terriers, I feel like there's not an endless number of decades stretching out. I feel good. I enjoy my work. So why not shift gears and leave them laughing? Literally, I'm having wonderful shows. People are having a good time. What's wrong with saying it's been great? I think I'll do a little more drawing.
So if somebody's listening to this right now and thinking, oh, no, I've never seen Tim Sample perform, you didn't stop yesterday, right? They still have a chance.
No. The way I did actually Jen, was this summer I took, for the first time, I took July and August completely off. I didn't book any shows. And I did that kind of dipping my toe in the water to see what it felt like. And it felt great. And everything was fine. And I said, okay, so I have a few shows left. That was a month or so ago. And right now in 2024, I have one show. If you go to timsample.com, you get the details. It's at the Colonial Theater in Laconia, New Hampshire. And it's an open, it's a big, beautiful theater. It's free. It's part of the, I think the Putnam Fund funds that. Anyway, so that'll be the 15th of November. And then I have a final show on the 26th or on or about the 26th of June. It's penciled in at the Opera House at Booth Bay Harbor, where I've been doing regular shows for years. And really a kind of a fun final show, because I performed there. I think I was 15 in a high school rock and roll band the first time I was on the stage at the Opera House. So I'll be 74 and I'll say goodbye. But there will be, I've had a few inquiries from other performing arts venues for the spring of next year. So keep, just go to timsample.com and my website, and it'll be listed. There will be a few chances to see me. And the other thing is, I'm making a plan to give away some CDs. Those CDs of mine, they're million sellers. We got a million in the cellar, so we appreciate anything you can do. So we're gonna be handing out some free autographed CDs as a way of saying thanks a lot for coming to these shows for all these decades.
Well, Tim, I only recently learned that you did not start out thinking you would be a comedian, and that it's because of one of our other favorite guests here on Maine Calling, Noel Paul Stuckey, that you had your career. Could you tell us that story?
I would be so happy to. I have had, as I say, so many wonderful mentors, so many wonderful opportunities. I was 25 years old in May of 1976, and I was asked to open. I was a singer, songwriter, guitar player, and had been playing around the bars and the clubs around Maine, but mostly around Portland for years. And I was asked to open for Noel Paul Stuckey, Paul of Peter, Paul and Mary. It was a big deal. And it was at what's now Merrill Auditorium, used to be Portland City Hall. So, you know, it was a huge venue. And this guy was world famous. And he could not have been nicer. Now, I've realized over the years, you know, I've opened for Tanya Tucker. I've opened for Loretta Lynn. I've opened for a bunch of different artists. Sometimes you meet them, sometimes you don't. Noel came into the dressing room, chatted with me. I was starstruck, and he very quickly put me at ease. And we found we had a lot of things in common, not least of which was cartooning. Noel's a cartoonist. A lot of people didn't know that. And he had started this recording studio, and he and I immediately started chatting about making animated films. And so that was 76. Within a year, I think, or a year and a half, I had moved down to South Blue Hill to the Hen House, and Noel and I and a couple other people had started New World Animation. And all that time, I would open for Noel periodically. And so it was around 78, 79, we were doing a series of shows, and we were, Dave Mallett was on the bill. You know, there were these, you know, it all felt like I was hitting the big time. But we were at the Maine State Music Theater at Lakewood doing this show. It was a sold out show. And Noel took me aside. So I'm like 27 now or 28. And he says, you know, we've got all these Caucasian acoustic guitar playing male singer songwriters right in a row, you, me, Mallet, you know. He said, you have this other skill, and I've watched you do it on stage in between songs where you make people laugh and you get things going. He said, I'm going to recommend, he said, you do anything you want, but why don't you go out and just MC the show, do 5 or 10 minutes, introduce the people, like it would be a better show. And I remember it was a big moment for me, because I could have been like, well, you like Dave Mallett better than you like me, and like that, you know. And then I said, I had seen pictures of Noel, you know, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963 with Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, you know. I said, maybe this guy knows something about the entertainment business. So that's what I did for the rest of that tour. And he, 2 years later, produced my first comedy album, and Marshall Dodge wrote the liner notes. And the rest is history. And I've never, and I still play music on stage and do stuff, but that was a watershed. And I've had many of those, but Noel Stuckey really is at the core of my professional. Without Noel Stuckey, I don't know what would have happened, but a wonderful guy.
He saw something in you didn't see in yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, it was a riot because we were doing that. Peter, Paul, and Mary got back together again about a year later. And all of a sudden, all these famous people were coming and going. I picked up the phone at the animation studio one night about 9 o'clock at night. I was working late. And this guy on the other end said, "Is this New World? Is this where Paul Stuckey is?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And I was like, "Yeah, I see him every day. You know, who are you?" And he said, "Well, tell him that I tell him I call it." He said, "Who are you?" He said, "Dion DiMucci." It was Dion from Dion and the Belmonts. And I'm like, I had grown up listening, and I thought, "Oh, my God, I about dropped the phone." So we had a lot of fun adventures along the way.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Tim, Noel Paul Stuckey saw something in you because you clearly were already pretty funny. Were you the kid? Were you the class clown? Were you the kid? I'm thinking about a certain boy who sat behind me in homeroom and made me laugh at inappropriate times all the time. Was that you? Were you trouble growing up?
I have all the backstory to be a stand-up comic. I had a closed head injury when I was 10 years old with an undiagnosed learning disability. I had that social awkwardness. I would talk in inappropriate ways, and I would cover it all by being very quick-witted and clever and diverting people's attention. So I was the class clown, but really, Jen, I can't, if I'm giving credit to people, I have to credit the paint crew at Sample Shipyard. My dad had a shipyard in Booth Bay Harbor, and I was a kid. I was like 11 or 12 years old, and I'd sweep the docks and bail out the boats and, you know, get 50 cents an hour and punch a time clock and all that. But these characters that I was exposed to, so some of these people, okay, so if it's 1962 and I'm 11 years old, there were guys there who were, you know, they would do these jobs like spinning oakum to caulk the decks of these wooden ships. And they were like in their early 80s. So they were like born in 1889 or something. And they had this incredible personality and the dialect. I always laugh when people said they thought that I exaggerated the main dialect. I said, "You never heard these guys." They would sit and talk, and this is what it sounded like. You couldn't even get a word. You'd have to pull a syllable out, try to match it with another syllable. But they had a wonderful sense of humor, and it was dry, and it just connected with that feeling. I had a feeling like a lot of adolescent kids do of being an outsider and not fitting in. And this was connecting me to a stream of narrative that predated my life, my parents' lives. It went back along the coast of Maine and back to the British Isles. I remember going to England for the first time, 1978, and I walked around gobsmacked thinking, now I know why they call where I live New England. Between the dialect and the colloquialisms and the storytelling, I said, yeah, this is a real thing. So that provided an anchor and a place to sort of hone my craft, I guess you'd say.
And I think a sensibility, right? Sort of like just a rejection of pomposity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's something Marshall Dodge always said, that Downey's humor punctures pomposity. But what it really does, what the real, the active ingredient in Downey's humor is perspective. And perspective is powerful in giving you a sense of foundation. So what would happen is, when I was a little kid, let's go back, and I'm 12 or 13 years old, and I'm talking to a bunch of these old guys sitting on the dock, just sitting there with one arm as long as the other talking. And what I've always said is, I could have walked up to that group of three or four guys and said, "There's a car on fire on Townsend Avenue." And this is what would happen. Nothing. For about 3 minutes. And then one of them would slowly turn to the other one and say, "Now, wasn't there a car on fire back in 42? Whatever happened to that car?" So you had this idea that everything that was happening, and remember, this was the 50s, the 60s, that was the Russian nuclear showdown with Kennedy and Khrushchev. It was the Cold War. It was the McCarthy era. There was a lot of the zeitgeist was pretty edgy. And these characters were like, well, no, I think I've seen that before. It'd be all right. And they had that lovely, the takeaway from a lot of the main humor, the way I do it, is just don't take yourself so darn seriously. Find yourself in the story. When you can laugh at yourself, when you can, one of the things to this day that I'm most proud of in my performing career, and I think back to the, you know, the polarization in the culture and the politics over recent couple of decades, but I would do a show in some town in Washington County, Aroostook County, you know, out in rural Maine. And it would almost always be a benefit for somebody. You know, this is rural Maine. You know, somebody has a health problem. You have a show, and you make some, bring in some money, and you help out. So I do these shows, and you could look in the parking lot, and there'd be Hillary bumper stickers and Trump bumper stickers and gay flags and everything under the sun, and yet all those people were in the same building at the same time, laughing at the same story. You see what I mean? And to me, that's a great unifier, is that what we're not talking about partisan, you know, I've prided myself for years on not trying to pick out some group, ethnic group or cultural group to mock. Now, having said that, we have a lot of fun in Maine with people from away. And that, the way I describe that is, It's gentle, but that it comes from a very real place. And here's the real place, especially on the coast. The coast of Maine is gorgeous. It's fabulous. Everybody knows that, right? It's also a really hard scrabble place to try to eke out a living. You have to have like five jobs. You have to go urchin diving. You have to sell, you know, knit sweaters. You have to do something, but you have to do a lot of things. So the thing about Maine, the from away factor, you can come from anywhere in the world and buy a house in Maine and have all the good things about Maine. The one thing you can't get is native status. So we hold that out like at the edge, like a carrot and a stick, you know. And there's a lot of old traditional Maine stories about that. The guy who's 99 years old and he's lived here his whole life. But I know the truth. He was originally born over to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He was 6 months old before he ever set foot in the state of Maine. So it's not mean-spirited, but it is a way of saying this is important to us. You know, I was born in northern Aroostook County, and I always, Josh, I joke on stage about the fact that when I go to the county, they call me a county boy. Every place else, I'm just an escapee. But the idea is you have to be from someplace, and it's important to you.
Before we go to our first break, I want to go to a call because it's Scott Nash. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, Scott.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
Hi, Scott. I am doing great. One of my favorite people, Scott Nash.
I want to be the first to welcome you back to the world of illustration and cartooning. Jennifer, this guy is good. He's part of our great state of illustration in Maine, and we couldn't be more pleased to have him. And Tim, I hope that you will continue to provide one particular form of performance, and I think you know what I mean, which is draw-offs.
Oh, I've had the great Scott good fortune. And I had a draw-off. Explain what a draw-off is, Scott.
So a draw-off is a quasi-competitive performance, basically, where we have two artists standing up in front of an audience with easels and blank sheet, you know, big blank sheets of paper. And we take requests from the audience, and it really is a form of improvisation. I've done it with I've done draw-offs with Chris Van Dusen, with Jamie Hogan, with Stephen Costanza, and others. But with Tim, you've got a whole nother level of improvisation in that you are good on your feet, my friend. You come up with some ideas that are incredibly original and incredibly funny. And it was such a joy to work with you on that up in Waterville. And I saw you a couple of weeks ago at the opening of the exhibition, and you mentioned that we would continue to do these things. So I'm hoping
Scott,
to now publicly state, yes, go ahead.
What is the exhibition you're talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the exhibition is from the Illustration Institute. I'm the executive director of the Illustration Institute. And what we have done is we put together an exhibit that's traveling around the state. That celebrates just the wealth of illustrators that are here in Maine. And I am constantly surprised in the 30 years that I've been here at how much talent comes to Maine, but specifically in the realm of illustration. It's incredible. And then I'm constantly uncovering new illustrators. I call this the land of hidden treasures. And yep. Tim, you were one of them. I wasn't familiar with your cartooning early on, but I certainly have become a huge fan. And now you've told me that Noel Paul Stuckey is also a cartoonist.
Oh yeah, Noel is a great cartoonist. But I want to give the listeners an example of, so when Scott and I had this draw off, and there's an audience as he describes, and we draw these, and the kids, mostly young people, yelled out, "Draw this," and we draw it, but we don't see what the other one's drawing. We each draw, and then at a certain point, we turn around and we see what we've drawn, and that's the fun of it. So at the last one, do you remember, Scott, the very last thing we got asked to do, we've been up on there for an hour or more doing drawings, and somebody said, "Draw a picture of Hope and Grace," and that was great, because Scott did this lovely sort of reminiscent to me of M.C. Escher with a hand drawing like a tattoo that said grace, then the other hand said hope, or words like something like that. Very, very sort of painterly and like a formal illustration. And what I did was a cartoon of two waitresses standing in front of something called the Reality Cafe with their name tags that said hope and grace. And
it
was
love
just,
it.
But what one of the things I love about the arts is that there's never a right answer. There's what people prefer.
Right.
It's that again, it goes back to what I was talking about. Perspective is a powerful thing. And if you're open to perspective and you're open to creative input, you can see things you otherwise wouldn't see. And then you can grow, and it helps you to empathize with people who perceive things not right or wrong, good or bad, but differently from the way you perceive things. And that's what I love about the creative world. And Scott does a wonderful job. And that's a wonderful show. It's up in University of Maine in Augusta now. And
yes,
what's the name of the gallery
there? We'll get information. We'll put it on our Facebook page. Scott
Great.
Nash, thank you so much for calling in. Scott Nash, an illustrator and also executive director of the Illustration Institute. So fun to hear from you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and today our guest is humorist and artist Tim Sample. Tim recently announced he will be stepping away from the stage to focus on his art. Share your comments and questions for Tim. We'd love to hear stories by email. A quick email, please. talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Tim, I want to circle back to something you said earlier about how your humor is never mean-spirited, never mocks someone. And I wanted to ask you about that because I've been struck by the opposite recently, seeing plays, seeing stand-up comedy, where there's sort of a casual cruelty sometimes. And I'm wondering if you see the same thing.
I see it, and I find it disturbing. I find it destructive on a kind of a cellular level. I'm nobody special in terms of my ability to tell stories, but I do have a certain sense of the value of each individual person. I'm very aware that there's a power as I alluded to earlier, in seeing yourself in the picture. I remember years ago, I mean, decades ago, I was doing an outdoor show at Deering Oaks Park, and there was it was for an organization that supported disability rights. And I wish I remembered this woman's name, but she was a female comedian, and someone will probably remember her in the audience. And she had MS. And she came on, and people in the audience, you know, there were people there in wheelchairs and who were struggling with the effects of MS. And she came out, and I'll never forget her opening line. She came out, she said, "Ha ha ha, hi, I'm so-and-so." She said, I don't have MS, I'm drunk. And everybody fell out, because one of the things people who have these deteriorating nerve diseases is people think they're drunk. So what she was doing in that, she was saying, we're all in this together. It was funny. She was making herself the brunt of the joke, but she was speaking to a bigger issue. And to me, if I can find, I'll give you a very, very, try to do this very quickly. I love cross-country motorcycling. And in the aftermath of the pandemic, the attack on the Capitol, all the very intense culture wars, one reason I drove across country on my big touring motorcycle. And one of the reasons I love doing that is kind of like a meditation. I don't tune into the news and the, you know, social media. I'm just by myself. So on the third day of my trip, I'm up in the mountains of West Virginia. I'm driving along, and I haven't thought about politics or these cultural clashes in days, and it feels great. And it's a beautiful sunny day. And this red pickup truck pulls up next to me, and a woman holds up a notebook, and it says something. I thought it said something about Trump. Trump won, or Trump lost, or Trump sucks, or something. But it was something about Donald Trump. And my reaction was, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think. Why did you inject that into my day? So I was all off my game, and I was irritated. And I said, I'm going to pull off and get some gas and relax and restart my day. I pulled off in the motorcycle, went to the gas pump, turned around, went back to the gas to gas up the motorcycle, and it turned out my travel trunk on the back of my motorcycle had come unlocked, and all my clothes were drifting out.
She said trunk!
And all she was saying is, your trunk is open. And and I tell that on stage because the takeaway is, who's the person with the toxic attitude in that? Who is... has just decided, I'm going to throw a toxic narrative. If I don't know what's going on, I'll fill in the blank with a toxic narrative. And I really brought myself up short. And I said, for the rest, from now on, if I don't know what's going on, I'm just going to simply say, I don't know what's going on. I'm not going to fill in the blank with some toxic narrative. So to me, that's the power of humor, to open up insight and give perspective. And if you're willing to do that, you can... I think it's the diversity in the human family is amazing, and people have different perspectives and that's not that's a strength, not a weakness. And to me, to be able to listen, I'm a big fan of Karen Morgan, who lives in Maine, but does. And Karen and I did one show years ago. But what I love, people ask me who I like. And I said, Karen can do a show. We saw her perform in Lewiston a while back. And she can get everybody laughing. And there's, I've been on stage for almost five decades, never once dropped the F-bomb, not once, because I don't see the point. And I feel like that about, what is that even like? Nobody can even comprehend. I said, come see the show. It's interesting to see that go on like that.
We're going to go to Jareth, who's calling from Sanford. Hi, Jareth. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, Tim. Great to talk to you. I think I saw you the first time about 50 years ago. You must have been just starting out because you were performing with the Wicked Good Band. I can't remember where. And I got their album on vinyl, and everybody signed it, and I got your autograph, too. That was pretty cool.
Cool.
I didn't know you rode dirt bikes. I've been riding dirt bikes since the 70s, and I host Observe Trials events in Maine almost every year. And that's a lot of fun, too. But That's a kind of cool thing to know. I'm an aspiring comedian myself, and I love your stuff, and Bert and I, and Joe Parham, and the whole gang there. And I've tried to do that storytelling at open mics, and most people just don't get it. It's not really barroom humor, so to speak, I guess.
No, it isn't. And that's a very good point, because one of the reasons that I never did much in the way of comedy clubs, I did a few of the comedy clubs back in the 80s, but that what I was doing was not what they were looking for. And one of the things I recommend to anyone who says what you just said, which is you're interested in storytelling, you're interested, there is an audience for that. But I'm a good example. I mean, I've sold millions of copies of books and albums and everything else, but it isn't necessarily the same audience as stand-up comedy. And understanding your audience, the way I always put it is, you could take the best folk act in the world and put them in a punk rock club and they'd bomb, not because they weren't any good, but because that wasn't the right venue for them. So that what I tell people is, find your audience. And if you have one, if you ever play anywhere and any significant number of people respond, you know you have an audience. The question after that is just marketing. Where are the rest of them?
Jared, thank you so much for calling in. We'll move on to your hometown, Booth Bay Harbor, and Christopher. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Mr. Tim Sample.
Hello.
So I had the pleasure of meeting you at BRTV when Tim Lewis did your interview, I think it was last year. Yeah.
Yep.
So I got a chance to sit there and chat with you for a while. Also had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Paul Stuckey down at Chocolate Church a couple of years ago. Got to see him live and got to chat with him. So that was kind of great through a mutual friend. But my question or questions are this. If I heard correctly, you're at the trail end of your career. Is that what you said?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm stepping down from 50 plus years of doing regular performances. And what I mean by that is for the last 50 years or so, you could look in the newspapers, look on the internet, you'd find out Tim Sample is going to be at the Chocolate Church this week. He's going to be at the Grand in Ellsworth the next week, the Caribou Performing Arts Center the next week. And I did a regular tour. And I would also, in between those open to the public shows, do a lot of after dinner speaking. I've done after dinner speaking shows and other shows in something like 26 or 27 of the 50 states. But what I've decided to do in my mid 70s is, I'm not saying I would never, for the the right cause or what have you, do MC a show or that. I'm not dropping out. But I am stepping back from performing on a regular basis to pursue some of my other interests, notably writing. I narrate audiobooks for Stephen King and Bob McCluskey and other people, and I like narration. I like writing. I like illustration. So I'm kind of concentrating on other aspects.
Understood. Would you... That the upcoming Booth Bay Opera House show, any chance that you might have that video for sale and such? What's her name? Kathy, Karen?
I've thought about that. I haven't spoken with Kathy about doing that, but that would be a possibility. I lose track, but I think I've done 8 or 10 primetime comedy specials I've done at least six for a Maine Public Broadcasting over the years, maybe 8. Anyway, and so it's always a possibility, but we're not anywhere down that. We haven't even firmed up the date. We think it's on or about the 26th of June, but watch this space. But that might be a fun thing to do.
Christopher, thanks for calling in. We're going to move quickly to Keith in Scarborough. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Good morning, folks. How are you today?
Great.
Wicked good.
Wicked good. So in 1978, we went to see you perform at what's now the Marrow, and you did this routine about the Swiss Army knife.
Yes.
And my wife
got a good memory.
We're continuing to laugh about it. And Noel Paul Stuckey was there, and Dave Mallett was there. It was the funniest routines in the history of comedy, I think. Jim. It was tremendous. Well, you remember that?
I appreciate that because that was from my very first comedy album, which has never been on CD. It was on vinyl, and it was produced by Noel Paul Stuckey. I will say this. Noel produced my first album with a cash out of his own wallet, and that made a big difference. And Marshall Dodge, this was before I was working with, wrote the liner notes. But that was recorded. There was a guy named Reg Bennett who had a geodesic dome in Hancock, Maine. And I was doing this routine, doing these stories. And he said, why don't you come out to the geodesic dome? We'll get a bunch of friends out there. And I think there were about 30 or 40 people. And I did that live. And the Swiss Army knife was basically the quick version of it was about how the Swiss Army, we just get the knife, but the actual Swiss Army, if the higher up in the army you go, the bigger the knife. And the top ones have nuclear weapons and they have like all this other. It just was taking the Swiss Army knife thing and just exploding it into absurdity, if I recall. But that's a hang on to that album. It was on my own label. Do you remember the name of the label that I produced that on?
I know is we saw you live at Merrill, and it was interesting because our native son, which he quite often does, complains about the PA, and Noel Paul Stuckey comes out there and doesn't say a word about it. And now he just come out with a garden song, which is a wonderful song.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I don't know about this PA and this and that, but it was I just want to call and share that story.
Thank you so much. That goes back.
Now I want to know what the name of the record label was, Tim.
It's called Elephant's Graveyard Records, A Mammoth Undertaking.
Oh, corny. Oh, boy.
Very corny.
Was this when they were excavating the woolly mammoth in southern Maine? Was there a link there?
I don't know what else went into it, but I did the logo, and Stuckey, God bless him, produced it. And like I say, I don't know where I'd be without Noel. He's been a wonderful supporter. And we performed Mallet, and Noel and I performed last year, just about a year ago this month, at the Common Ground Fair. And the first time I performed at the Common Ground Fair was 1981 with Marshall Dodge. And all those years ago.
Keith, thank you so much for calling in. We do need to take another quick break. We are talking with Tim Sample on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program. What is next for Tim Sample? Join our conversation. 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. Let's see. We will go to Al, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Al. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everyone. My name's Al, and I just want to briefly maybe bring Tim back. I want to thank you, first of all, Tim, for all your years of entertainment and what you've done. And I just want to go back a little further, maybe the late 60s or 70s, and if you can remember a place called The Gate in Portland.
Oh, yeah. Seminal performing arts space, yes.
That's right. And also, I don't know what the car was that you had at the time, but the thing was painted the American flag, and how impressive that was.
Yep, that was the first time. Thank you very much, Al. That was 1969. I came to Portland from Booth Bay Harbor, and you can get the whole story on my album, Ain't Life Grand, that came out in 1999. But it was a 56 Chevrolet Bel Air sports sedan with four doors and no B pillar, if you know what that means. And I had painted it to resemble an American flag. And it was the first time I got on the front cover of the Portland Press Herald above the fold, because it was a huge kerfuffle. The Portland police dragged the car into the garage, and they arrested me, or didn't arrest me, but they charged me with defiling the flag. And everybody, again, in the act, Walter Cronkite, whom I later met when I worked at CBS News, it was a great honor to meet him, at the end of the evening news said, "And finally, in Portland, Maine today, an art student named Tim Sample has been called," or blah, blah, blah. And it was all over the AP. It was a big deal. But the good news is I was acquitted of all charges, but I did have a taste of what it's like to be a public person with a supercharged issue that nobody was on the sidelines about. Everybody thought you were either a super patriot or a communist sympathizer or something.
Oh, and Al, I'll keep you on for a second because an email from Lori just came in. Tim, I recently enjoyed listening again to your story about painting the car with stars and stripes. And she puts a laughing emoji. Thanks so much for your brand of clean and funny humor. She ends her email by saying, now I need to find your aht. And she spells it A-H-T and says, gratefully, Lori.
Great.
Al, thanks so much for calling in with that story. We'll go up to Vassalboro and George. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Back in 1972, when I got out of the Army, I went to visit my aunt, who worked at a bed and breakfast in Booth Bay. And just for a visit, and the owner of the bed and breakfast walked me into what he had, a music room with a piano. He went over and put on a record, walked out of the room and closed the door. I go, well, this is weird. It was one of your albums. And I'm sitting there going, what the heck's going on? And I'm trying to absorb what's happening. Anyways, years later, my son and I memorized almost all your tapes and stuff. As a matter of fact, yesterday I was going to the dump. I said, I'm going to the dump. My son says, how you getting back?
Yeah, so, that's from one of my lines about our boy Yuba. Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, one of the great honors and privileges and pleasures of my life is when people will tell me stories about when they heard this this routine or when they bought that tape. Nancy Dysart at Dysart's Truck Stop up in Bangor, they used to sell a ton of my audio cassettes back in those days. It was long before the internet. And Nancy told me one time, she said, I never told you this, Tim, but all these truck drivers would come in, these long-haul truckers that were going from California to Maine and back and across the country, and they would come in and they'd say, do you have that tape where that guy talks about that diner with the guys eating beans? And they'd say, yes. And then what they would do is they'd go across the country, and they had an open CB band among the truckers, and they'd find a routine that they'd like, and they'd put on the PA, and they'd play it. And I said, this is going viral before the internet existed, and the truckers would get back to Maine and buy one of those albums. So thank you for that memory, because that's exactly how that works.
You know, Tim, that's really profound that there are people out there who have memorized that, that's crossed generations, that his son quotes one of your lines back at you. I'm guessing that at some point you can't even think about it too hard because it's too big.
It's just wonderful. You know, I have people come up to me and they will say, and this is another generation of people. Most of the, you know, I was only 30 years old when I was doing this. I was the youngest. You know, people, Joe Parham, Marshall Dodge, Kendall Morse, Bobby Bryan, all these people were of a whole other generation. And so I had the people that were listening to my albums when they first came out, like in the 80s, were often in their 40s or 50s. And that now their kids will come up to me and say, you know, they'll be like 40. So quickly, one guy came up to me at the Samoset when I was doing a show years ago, great big guy with a beard about 6.5 feet tall. He said, Mr. Sample, I just want to tell you, you were the first person my parents ever let me go to see a live show. And I thought, okay, again, this will be good. I said, when was it? And it was the Common Ground Fair in 1981 with Marshall Dodge, probably the biggest crowd I'd ever entertained, 3,000 or more people at the Windsor Fairgrounds. He was 6 years old. He said his dad put him on his shoulders, and he listened to the whole show, and he laughed at the show. And here he was years later, a grown man walking in. And what's better than that, to have that through line through the lives of people who find something valuable in what I have put on vinyl or tape or on the TV or whatever. That, I don't, if it gets any better than that, I don't know how it would be.
George, thank you so much for calling in. We'll move on to Portland and Flash. Hi, Flash. Go ahead.
Oh, Flash.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh,
hi.
My.
Hi, Tim.
Flash. A flash of Flash and Tina.
How the hell are you?
I am, you know what, able to set up and take nourishment. Flash goes way back, to the gate and other. Flash is one of the few people who would know when I talk about Joe and Nino's circus room, he'd know exactly what I was talking about.
Joe and Nino's, oh man, the crow's nest, the whole thing. Anyways, I didn't
the crow's nest.
I just wanted to know if you had already talked about your time, and was it the Apart Band? Was that what you were? Was that the name of the band?
Oh, the Apart Band was the duo I had with Steve Colley was Deftet. And in 19, people should know this, in January of 1970, the Mothers of Invention were playing at Gorham Teachers College back then, UMPG. We got the night off from playing at the Siemens Chapel Club. We used to start at midnight and go till 4 a.m. I was 19 years old. And Bill Terry, who ran the club, said, "Do you know where exit 8 is?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Get in the car and go show this guy where exit 8 is." And we went out after watching the Mothers the night before, and we picked up Jimmy Carl Black, Flo and Eddie, Mark Bowman and Howard Kalin from the Turtles, Jeff Simmons, and they came back and we jammed with them. I had seen the Turtles on the Smothers Brothers or something 2 years earlier. So, but Flash,
Ed Sullivan.
Oh yeah, well Flash remembers all this stuff, and there was a lot going on the street in Portland in the old days. Yes.
Oh, there was. I missed that. Now it's a sleepy little town now, but it used to be awake all night.
Flash, before we let you go, is there anything you want to tell us about Tim Sample that people might not?
Well, I've seen him sing. I've seen him with, you know, hippie garb and long hair, and you cut quite the figure, Tim.
Yeah. Remember, at one point I had the whole front of my head shaved and the back down to my shoulders, and I wore in this band, Deftet. Flash remembers this. I held a crutch with a guitar strap, and I wore a holster strapped around my waist with a fake fruit dangling out of the holster. So this was 1969. If I fit right in.
It sounds like quite a look, a shaved front of your head and long hair in the back. Oh, my goodness. Flash, I so appreciate you calling in and adding to this program. Flash calling in from Portland. And what was the name of your band?
My band was, she put it back in Stone Flute. I think it was Stone Flute back then.
Yeah.
Stone Flute.
He was a great keyboard player.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Flash, thank you so much for calling in. Tim, we have just a couple minutes left, and I just wanted to ask you, you know, for years you were on CBS Sunday Morning and sending out letters for Maine, and I'm wondering about that responsibility, if you will, of introducing the rest of the country to your state. How did you deal with that?
It was wonderful. First of all, another great mentor, great, great teacher was Charles Kuralt. And of course, Charlie Osgood was there for most of the years, but Charles Kuralt handpicked me, came to visit me, offered me the job at CBS, and it was like playing in the NBA. Over the course of those years, the one thing I told Kuralt, I said, I would be so honored to do this, but the one thing I am going to tell you is I'm not going to just show the parts of Maine everybody already knows. And in the course of 11 years, we had the National Symphony Orchestra in Caribou in the middle of the winter. You know, I interviewed, you know, people like Jamie Wyeth and Robert Indiana and Bob McCluskey and all these people. But we also would go and do very Kuraltian stories. You know, the only graduate of the island school at Little Cranberry Island, who was the eighth grader who had been there since kindergarten. It wasn't a dry eye in the house. But the wonderful thing about working at CBS News was, and it was, they had production budgets that were fat. They had high quality post-production. We'd shoot 16 or 18 hours of footage for something that would be on the air for 5 minutes or 6 minutes. And my crew, I'll finish with this, he's no longer with us, but Izzy Bleckman and Larry Gianeschi were my first crew, and those are the two guys that spent almost 20 years on the road, driving the bus and working. It was Carrault's old crew, and he gave them to me. He said, these guys will do a good job. And Mary Lou Teal, I can't say anything without saying, she was my producer for 11 years. Great job. It was a privilege.
Well, Tim Sample, I hope you'll come back to Maine Calling.
Please, anytime.
Tim Sample stepping away from live reporting, but not going anywhere. You'll see his illustrations more often. Thank you for joining us on Maine Calling. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Maine Calling produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can visit Maine Calling for our audio archives and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Again, that's mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about just what the phrase midlife means and why we might want to think about it a little more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.